You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Eurythmy as Visible Speech, Collected Works, Volume 279, translated by Vera and Judy Compton Burnett. This is Lecture 2, entitled The Character of the Individual Sounds. Yesterday I attempted to portray the general character of speech as such, and the character of this visible speech, of eurythmy in particular. Today I should like to describe the characteristics of the individual sounds, for only when the character and inner nature of these sounds reveal themselves to us shall we be able to understand the elements of eurythmy. To begin with, I should like to draw attention to the fact that in the life of humanity, in the course of human evolution, there has always been a more or less definite consciousness of these things. It is only in our time that, as I said yesterday, we have become so shriveled up with regard to our attitude toward speech. There has always existed a certain consciousness of all that lies in the progression of sounds as they occur in language, an understanding of the fact that in the consonants there lies an imitation of outer forms or outer happenings, and that an inward experience is contained in the vowel sounds. This consciousness has been carried over more or less into the forms of the letters, so that in the formation of the letters in ancient languages, in the Hebrew language, for example, in the case of the consonants, we may still see a sort of imitation of what takes place in the air, of what forms itself in the air when we speak. To a great extent, this has been lost in all the modern languages. Among these, I naturally include all those which, let us say, begin with the Latin language. The Greek language still retains something of what I mean. Many things, however, still recall the time when attempts were made to imitate in the forming of the letters that which actually lies in the formation, in the structure of the word. When a word was fashioned out of the consonantal element, that is to say, the imitation of the external, and out of the inner experience which had its source in the life of the soul. Today it is only in certain interjections that we can still see clearly an instance of such imitation. Let us take an example which may serve to lead us more deeply into the real nature of eurythmy. When we pronounce the sound H, ha, clearly, not merely as a breath, we have a sound which really lies midway between the consonant and the vowels. This is always the case with sounds which have a special relation to breathing. Breathing was always felt to be something in which the human being lives partly in an inner experience and partly in an outgoing experience. Now the H sound, this simple breath sound, may be felt, and was indeed felt by primitive man, as the imitation, the forming in the air of a wafting process, as the imitation of the way in which the breath is wafted into the surrounding atmosphere. Everything which is experienced as a wafting process is expressed through some word in which the H sound is present, because the H itself is felt as the wafting process. The vowel sound U, U, can be felt as something which inwardly chills the soul, so that it takes on a certain rigidity and numbness. That is the inward experience lying behind U. U is the expression of something which chills, stiffens, benumbs. It is the sound which gives one the feeling of coldness. U, then, is the chilling, stiffening process. And the sh, that is the blowing away of something. It is the sound in which one feels that something is blowing past. Now, it is a fact that in certain districts, when an icy wind is blowing and one is numbed and stiff with the cold, people make use of the expression hush, 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 hush. In this interjection, we still have an absolute experience of the h-u-sh, hush, hush. In primeval language, all words were really interjections, ejaculations. Let us take another combination of sounds. You all know the sound R. If one experiences the R sound in the right way, one feels it as a turning wheel. R, R, R. Thus the R expresses a rolling, a revolving. It is the imitation of anything which gives the impression of turning, rolling, revolving. We must think of it, picture it like this, and there's a picture. Yesterday I spoke already of the sound ah. I told you that ah expresses wonder. The sh sound has already been described. It is the blowing past of something. And now we are able to feel the word rash, swift. It is easy to picture it. When anything rushes past, it creates a certain wonder and disappears, is blown away. Rash. So you see, there is a good reason for regarding the consonants as being an imitation. Here we have in the R the revolving, rolling, turning of something. In the vowel sound, ah, the inner feeling of wonder. In the sh sound, something goes away, which passes by. From these examples, you can already see that there is a certain justification for speaking of a primeval language. For you can feel that if human beings really experienced the sounds absolutely truly, they would all speak in the same way. They would quite naturally, out of their own organization, describe things exactly in the same way. It is a fact, as spiritual science teaches us, that there was once upon the earth a primeval language. You all know myths and legends dealing with this. But it is much more than a myth or a legend. There is really something which lies at the back of all languages, and which is, in the way I have described, the primeval language from which all other languages have been built up. When one turns one's attention to certain facts of life and sees how, out of an infinite wisdom, they have been given similar names, then one is quite overwhelmed with the wisdom which reigns in the whole evolution of man, indeed in the whole evolution of the world. Consider the following, my dear friends, and what I am now going to bring forward is no mere triviality. It rests on an actual primal sense of man. For people who think deeply over the problems which present themselves to the understanding, certain things that bear a somewhat intimate relationship to life itself become riddles. Riddles which are simply passed over by the more blunted sensibilities of the average man. Passed over by the more blunted sensibilities of the average man. The fact that there is a similarity between the words mother milk and mother tongue may well be looked upon as a riddle of this kind. It is clear that one would not say father milk, but the reason for not saying father tongue is less apparent. Where are we to seek for this parallel between mother milk and mother tongue? There are always inner reasons for such things. It is true that the external reasons may frequently be brilliantly proved, but for these intimate facts of human evolution, inner reasons are always to be discovered. When the child comes into the world, a mother's milk is the best nourishment for the physical body. Such things do not properly belong to lectures on eurythmy, but if we had the necessary time and if we were to analyze the mother's milk in the right way, not with the dead methods of chemistry, but with a living chemistry, we should find out why it is that the mother's milk is the best nourishment for the physical body of man during the first stages of life. Indeed, speaking from the medical scientific point of view, one may go so far as to say that the milk of the mother is the best means of building up, of actually giving form to the physical body. This is the first thing we have to realize. It is the mother's milk which gives form to the physical body. And it is the mother tongue. We said yesterday that the mother tongue corresponds to the etheric body. It is the mother tongue which develops and gives form to the etheric body. For this reason, we have a similarity between the words. First, there appears the physical body, with its need for the mother's milk, and then the etheric body, with its need for the mother tongue. A deep wisdom lies hidden in such things. We find the deepest wisdom not only in those word formations which can be traced back to ancient times, but also in many proverbial sayings and ideas. We should not look upon the wisdom concealed in old sayings and proverbs merely as superstition, but should recognize that very often wonderful and significant traditions are contained within them. Having said this, having made my meaning clear to you, let us now proceed to a description of the nature of the sounds. When we understand what the sounds represent, how the vowels are the expression of inward experiences, and the consonants the imitation of the external world, when we understand how this is the case in every single instance, then we are led to a threefold study of eurythmy: artistic, educational, and curative. I shall make use of everything which could possibly serve to give you a vivid picture of the individual sounds as they really are, so that tomorrow you will be able fully to understand the plastic gestures which we make use of in eurythmy. In ah, there lies a feeling of wonder, astonishment. In b, as I told you yesterday, we have the imitation of something which protects and shelters us from what is outside ourselves. In b, we feel that we are enveloped in something. This can even be seen in the way the letter is formed. Only in modern writing the sheath is, as it were, doubled. B. B is always an enveloping, a kind of shelter. To put it somewhat crudely, B might be said to be the house in which one lives. B is a house. In my characterization of the various sounds in speech eurythmy, I shall take the German language as my starting point. I could just as easily take the sounds of more ancient languages, but we will make a beginning with the German sounds and see how these reveal themselves to us in their true nature. Coming now to the sound ts, I shall naturally not go into the formation of the written letters, as these have mostly become degenerate, and in any case, eurythmists do not need to interest themselves so much in language from this point of view. Coming now to the sound ts, ts, you will feel it to be something which is in movement. It would be impossible to feel that with the sound ts, one would try to imitate anything which is in a state of rest. There is a certain impact in the sound ts. Nevertheless, when you really experience what lies behind it, you will realize how impossible it would be to picture anything heavy in connection with it. It would never occur to you that with ts, you would wish to imitate something which would make you get into a great heat if you tried to lift it. On the contrary, the feeling that one has is that here is the imitation of something which is the reverse of heavy, which is really very light. It is the quality of lightness that is really imitated in the sound ts. Thus one can say quite simply, in ts we have the imitation of lightness. If you enter into the intimate nature of the different sounds, you will, in the case of ts, have much the same feeling as if in a circus you saw weights, apparently made of iron and marked so and so many hundred weight, lifted up quickly and easily by the clown. Imagine that you were to approach such a weight, in the belief that it were made of iron and immensely heavy, and that you were to lift it up. You would approach it, and in suddenly raising it, you would produce a movement very similar to the sound ts. We have the same thing in nature, for sneezing is not all at unlike a ts. Sneezing is a lightening process. It was said by the old occultists that the sound ts in primeval language was the regent of health. And in Austria, when a person sneezes, we still have a saying, zur Gesundheit, parenthesis, your very good health, close parenthesis. These are feelings which must be taken into consideration when studying the sounds. Otherwise, we shall not be able to come to any understanding of them and their reality. D. When should we be most naturally wishing to use the sound D? D If someone were to ask you where a thing was and you knew, the movement you would make to show him you can feel it would be best accompanied by the sound d. And if you wished to indicate that you expected your questioner to be astonished at getting such a speedy answer, then you would say da there. If you leave out the astonishment, the wonder, then there remains just the d. In such a case, you are not so conceited as to wish to call up in your questioner the feeling of wonder. You simply show him where the thing is. In expressing d, one makes what may be called indicating movements raying out in all directions. It is not difficult to feel this. So that we may say, d is the pointing toward something, the raying out toward something. The imitation of this pointing, of this raying out, of this drawing attention to something, all this lies in the sound d. A is a sound which has always been of very special interest. As you already know, A is the sound which gives expression to the feeling that something has been done to us, and we stand up against it. A. We will not allow what has been done to trouble us. Here it may be well to introduce the sound t, tau, and to explain its significance. You are perhaps already aware that a deep reverence rises up in those who begin to understand what lies in this sound. This tau, t, is really the sound which has to be felt as representing something of the greatest importance. We may even go so far as to say that it contains within it creative forces, forces which also have a radiating, indicating quality. But with t, it is more especially a radiance which streams from heaven down onto the earth. There is a weightiness about the sound, and at the same time also a radiance. Thus we can say, t is the streaming of forces from above downward. Now it is, of course, possible for something which under certain conditions has to be felt as having great and majestic qualities also to make its appearance in ordinary everyday life. Let us take three sounds. Let us first take A, as we have learned to know it. A expresses the feeling, something has been done to me, but I stand up against it and assert myself. T, tau, something has burst in upon me. Let us try to show what is contained in this experience. Something has been done to me, but I stand up against it. A. An event has taken place, it has suddenly burst in upon me. T, but it is soon over. It passes over, the blowing away of something. Sh. In this way we get the following combination of sounds, etch. When do we make use of this expression? We use it when, for instance, somebody makes an important statement, which is, however, false, and we immediately jump to the conclusion that it is false. Now when we are in a position immediately to get rid of what has affected us, when the statement or whatever it is has burst in upon us like a flash of lightning, but we destroy it and blow it away, then we say etch. Here we have an explanation of this combination of sounds. One feels the A particularly strongly, the being affected by something. One could not imagine saying itch or ach at such a point. But in an experience of this kind, when one has been affected by something but has been able immediately to get rid of it, then one obviously must use the expression itch. Sorry, readers aside, I think I was pronouncing that slightly wrong. It's spelled E-T-S-C-H. I believe he means me to pronounce that H. End of readers aside. Now, out of the way in which you form the movement for A, out of your knowledge of eurythmy, you will be able fully to enter into the gesture that in many districts accompanies this expression. This gesture is really very similar to the eurythmic movement for A, H, H, showing the corresponding movement. Here we actually have the eurythmic movement for A. Such movements are absolutely natural and instinctive. Thus, behind the sound A, there lies the experience of being affected by something and of withstanding it. Naturally, when one describes such things, the description tends to be awkward and inadequate. Everything depends on being able to feel what is meant. F is a sound which is somewhat difficult to experience in an age which has such a lifeless, dried-up conception of language. But it may perhaps be of assistance to us, my dear friends, if I remind you of a phrase which you all know and which is in fairly general use. People say when somebody knows a thing upside down and inside out, er kennt die Sache aus dem F. Parenthesis, he knows it out of the F. Close parenthesis. An extraordinarily interesting experience lies behind this phrase. When one finds the man in the street making use of such an expression and compares it with what was said in the old mysteries, the result is truly remarkable. Parenthesis, you remember I said that I should make use of everything which could help us to gain a true understanding of the sounds. Whether my examples were drawn from a cultured or from a more primitive source, the latter being the more fruitful naturally, close parenthesis. In the ancient mysteries there was still a living understanding of the words, quote, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, close quote. There was still a living feeling for the creative power of the Word, of the Logos. Parenthesis, Logos is not to be translated wisdom. Indeed, by doing so, many modern scholars have betrayed their lack of understanding for these things. Logos must unquestionably be translated verbum, word. Only the word, word, must be understood in the right way, in the way in which I explained it yesterday, close parenthesis. Now, in the old mysteries of Western Asia, Southern Asia, and Africa, it was said when speaking about the sound F, when a man utters the sound F, he expels out of himself the whole stream of his breath. It was by means of the breath that the gods created man, and the whole of human wisdom is contained in the air, in the breath. So that all the Indian was able to learn when, through yoga philosophy, he learned to control his breathing, and as a result was able to fill himself with inner wisdom, all this he felt when he uttered the sound F. In the old Indian yoga practices, the pupil had the following experience. He practiced yoga exercises, the technique of which consisted in this, that he became inwardly aware of the organization of man, inwardly aware of the fullness of wisdom. In uttering the sound F, he became conscious of the wisdom contained in the word. F can therefore only be rightly understood when one tries, even today, to understand a certain formula, which is very little known in the world, but which, nevertheless, did once exist, and in the old Egyptian mysteries ran somewhat as follows. If thou wouldst proclaim the nature of Isis who contains within herself the knowledge of the past, present, and future, and from whom the veil can never entirely be lifted, then thou must do this in the sound F. The making use of the process of breathing, in order to fill oneself with the being of Isis, the experiencing of Isis in the outgoing breath stream, this it is that lies in the sound F. So that F, not indeed exactly, but at any rate to some extent, can be felt as the expression of I know. But more lies in it than this. I know is really only a feeble expression of what we should feel in the sound F. For this very reason, the feeling for F was soonest lost. F may be felt somewhat as follows. Know thou, to whom I speak, when I say F to thee, I would make thee aware that I can teach thee. Thou must know that I myself have knowledge. It would therefore seem natural to you, absolutely natural, if someone desirous of putting another right were suddenly to approach him, giving vent to a sound similar to F. There are many interesting words, words which would well repay study, in which the sound F occurs in some connection or other. The study, however, you can carry out for yourselves, and you will be reminded of all that I have told you about the inner nature of the sound F. I have already spoken about the sound h. We know that it is the blowing, the wafting past of something. And now e. It is easy to feel e as an assertion of oneself, as positive self-assertion. In the German language, there is a very happy example of this. It is our word for the expression of the affirmation or the assertion of something, ja, yes. Here, certainly, there is the indication of a consonantal element, but the e is nevertheless present and is followed by wonder, by amazement. Assent of affirmation cannot be better expressed than by assertion of self colored by wonder. We said yesterday that the quality of wonder really represented man in his true being. And when we add to this the assertion of oneself, ja, then we could not have a clearer, more definite expression of the affirmative. Thus in I, we have the assertion of self. We shall see how important it is for eurythmists to understand that behind the sound I, there is always a vindication of oneself, an assertion of oneself. L is a very remarkable sound. As I am pronouncing it now, it contains a hint of e, of a, but I mean the pure sound l. Try to realize what you really do when you pronounce l. Try to realize especially what you do with your tongue. You use your tongue in a very skillful way when you pronounce the sound l, 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 l. You become aware of a creative form-giving element when saying this sound. Indeed, if one were not too terribly hungry, one might almost satisfy one's hunger by simply saying the sound L very distinctly and over again. We feel L to be something absolutely real, for example, as if we were to eat a dumpling, especially nice, soft dumpling, and were to allow it to melt on the tongue with a feeling of great satisfaction. We can have a like experience when we pronounce the sound L, 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 very distinctly. There's something creative, something form-giving in this sound. And a sculptor is very much tempted when working on the figures which he is creating to make a movement of the tongue, similar to the movement which the tongue makes when forming the sound L. Though, of course, the sculptor does not say L aloud. He only makes a similar movement with his tongue. And anyone able to feel the shape of a nose, for instance, with his tongue, where the feeling for form, the feeling of L, is so strong, such a one would undoubtedly be very successful in modeling noses. It was said in the old mysteries that L is the creative, form-giving element in all things and beings, the force which overcomes matter in the creation of form. You will easily feel that the diphthong I corresponds to an affectionate caress. When dealing with a child, one often makes use of this sound, I, an affectionate caress. I shall next have to describe the sound M, and we shall see that M has the quality of entering right into something, of taking on the form of something outside oneself. Readers aside, M as in mother, end of readers aside. Let us now suppose, my dear friends, and here again I am not merely trifling, but what I have to say is drawn from out of the history of the ages. Let us suppose that we had some sort of substance, and assume that this substance should be the means of transforming matter, of giving form to matter. Let us put the story together. In the first place, we demand of this substance that it shall transform matter and give it form and shape. That is to be its main attribute. It is to give form to matter, but in such a way that it clings closely and lovingly to something other than itself, in much the same way as when one caresses a little child, I. This is the expression of a caressing quality. The substance must cling to something, and this clinging quality must be retained. The substance must, as it were, take on a form which is foreign to it, so that it appears exactly the same as this external form. It imitates this form quite exactly. And now let us suppose that we express this transformation of matter into form by means of a combination of sounds, we say El, the clinging quality, I, the taking on of some external form, M. Thus we have the word lime, glue, which is quite specifically characteristic, which is quite specially characteristic in the German language, quite apart from any other consideration. It is upon such combinations of sound, behind which there lies hidden the active, evolving genius of language, that the life of this genius of language really depends. It occurs from time to time that when in some language or other a word already exists, although perhaps in a vague, indefinite form, that this word is metamorphosed and introduced again into a language of a later development, retaining a similarity to its original feeling, if the nation which receives it has a sense for it. An understanding of language is a much more complicated matter than is usually supposed. Today people treat language in a really terrible fashion. In ordinary, everyday life, which rests upon superficiality and convention, such a treatment of language is perhaps not out of place. But its effect upon the human soul is nothing short of devastating. How utterly devastating it is impossible to say. It is impossible to say. For instance, somebody wishes to translate a book or a poem, so he proceeds to hunt in the dictionary, or to search his memory, in order to discover the corresponding words. And, having more or less transposed it in this way, he calls it a translation. But it would really be more correct to call it a mistranslation, for this is a wrong track altogether. Nothing is more appalling than this method of transferring something from one language into another. Let us therefore study this question from the following point of view. Assuming there was once a primeval language, alike, of course, for all men, and there is no doubt that this language did exist, assuming that there was once a primeval language, then the question naturally arises, how is it that the many different languages came into being? How does it come about that if we take a German word, the word Kopf, head, for instance, and translate it into Italian, we have to say testa. We have the German word Kopf, and we have the Italian word testa. When we begin to enter into the true nature of languages, we must ask ourselves the question, how is it that the Italian feels the sounds in testa, which are totally different from those felt by the German when he makes use of the word Kopf? According to the rules of translation, the two words should have the same significance. If the word Kopf were really to be experienced, then the Italian and even the Chinese would perforce have to say Kopf also. How then can the origin of the different languages be explained? What I am now going to say may make you double up with laughter, but it is nevertheless true. The German makes use of the word Kopf. The Italian would also make use of this word if he wished to designate the same thing, but he does not wish to do so. The German point of view lies outside his field of vision. What the German expresses in the word Kopf, that to which he gives the name Kopf, does not occur in the vocabulary of the Italian language. Were the Italian desirous of expressing the same thing, he, like the German, would say Kopf. What then does the German mean when he says Kopf? He means to describe the form, the rounded form of the head. It is easy to feel this rounded form in the word Kopf. Later on, when we have studied the sound K and all that we need in this connection, we shall be able to realize more clearly that it is the rounded form which is meant here. Now, when the word Kopf is shown in eurythmy, try to see how this rounding appears in the middle of the word, and there's a demonstration. The German describes as Kopf the rounded form of the head as it rests on the shoulders. Were the Italian to have the same experience, he also would say Kopf, not testa. What then does he experience? The Italian does not experience the rounded form, but he feels what is implied in a statement, in a testimony. He is more aware of what underlies the word testament. Thus the act of making a testimony, making a declaration, an affirmation, this it is which is felt by the Italian, and for this reason he says Testa. He means something totally different from the German. The words Kopf and Testa only appear to describe the same thing. In reality, they are fundamentally different. In the one case, in the German word, the form of the head is described as it rests upon the shoulders. And in German, if one wishes to lay emphasis upon the roundness of the form, one can make use of an expression which has in it, at the same time, a certain element of contempt, and say, Kohlkopf, cabbage head, blockhead. You will agree with me that here there can be no shadow of doubt that the rounded form is meant. But the head as it rests upon the shoulders is not felt as a round form by the Italian. He feels it to be something which makes an assertion, a declaration. For this reason he says testa, and feels in this word all that I have described. This lack of understanding is very general among translators. As a rule, we translate without paying any attention to the fact that we should transpose ourselves into the whole atmosphere of the other language in order to catch its exact shades of meaning. Just think how external it is when one translates according to a dictionary. One misses just those things which are most essential and passes them by in sublime unconsciousness. Let us now turn to the sound M, that sound which makes such a wonderful ending in the sacred Indian word Aum. M contains within it the element of comprehension, of understanding. In the way in which the sound is carried on the stream of the breath, we feel that it conforms itself to everything and understands everything. M signifies that which is deeply felt and understood. I remember that my village schoolmaster said "mn" when he wanted to show that I had answered a question rightly. Reader's aside, not sure how to pronounce that. M-H-N. And the reader's aside. At such times he always said "mn." That is, he understood it, he agreed with it. The "hin" was only the expression of his satisfaction. M, therefore, may be said to be the expression of agreement. It clings to something and is in agreement with it, as the M at the end of the word lime. It is clear from these few examples that in each sound there lies concealed a whole world of experience. And we can easily realize that if we were to express ourselves by means of sounds only, instead of using our ordinary words, we should indeed have a simpler and more primitive language. But it would be one which would combine with this simplicity a much deeper intimacy and understanding. As eurythmists, it is very necessary that you should gradually feel your way into the real nature of the sounds. For eurythmy does indeed consist of a plastic formation of movement and gesture. Such movements are, however, in no way arbitrary nor transient. On the contrary, the movements of eurythmy are cosmic in their nature. They are full of significance. They could in no way be other than they are. In the next lecture, I shall describe to you the other sounds which I have not touched upon today, and then gradually we shall consider the main characteristics of the actual movements which we use in eurythmy. We shall see how these movements express, in their very essence, exactly the same as is expressed by the sounds themselves, as they are breathed into the air, as they take shape in the air. Recap: awe, wonder, amazement; b, to wrap around, to envelop; ts, the quality of lightness; d, to indicate, to ray outward; a, to be affected by something and to withstand it; t, a significant streaming from above downward; f, thou knowest that I know; e, assertion of self; l, the overcoming of matter by form; M, to be in agreement; H, the wafting breath sound; U, the becoming chilled and stiffened; Sh, the blowing past of something; these three as in the word hush; R, rolling, revolving; ah, wonder; Sh, blowing past; Rash. and then L, the transforming of matter into form, I, the quality of clinging, M, imitation, combined with understanding, as in the word lime. End of lecture 2.